Good morning. My name is Christy, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the conference call hosted by JFNA and JCPA. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the call over to Richard Sandler, Chair of the JFNA's Board of Trustees. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. I thank you for joining us from Jewish federations from across North America and also from the Jewish Council on Public Affairs. As we all know, 5 days ago, the U.S. opted to abstain in a UN Security Council vote on a resolution that was sharply critical of Israel. And yesterday, Secretary of State Kerry delivered his speech trying to explain that decision and setting forth certain thoughts or ideas that he had in the way he wanted to present it. In that speech, Secretary Kerry delivered what he called the practical suggestions on how to move both the Israelis and the Palestinians towards peace. And we are really privileged and very fortunate this morning to have with us an individual who has the greatest knowledge and insight on Middle East and what's going on in the Middle East of anyone I've met, David Makovsky. And David is in Jerusalem. I'm in Los Angeles. The rest of us are across North America. And let me turn it over to you, David, and thank you so much for giving us your time this morning and trying to explain to us what's going on.
All right, well, thank you very much, and thank you to all the JFNA, JCPA. You know, you guys do, you know, really wide-ranging work, and so happy Hanukkah to all of you. What I'm going to try to do here, and I try to keep it to 20 minutes if I can, is to try to look at the Kerry speech and maybe also in the Q&A deal with the Security Council resolution. If I can kind of pull that into the opening remarks, and then we can have a discussion back and forth. So why don't we just dive into it? Look, as you know, the waning days of the Obama administration, Secretary of State Kerry, who I should say that I worked for during 2013-14 when we had a live peace process, issued a very stern critique to Israel about a slide to one-state solution and six principles that he said would guide peacemaking to end the conflict and lead to a two-state solution with Israel and the Palestinians. I want to just go through it, what's new in this, and I do not hide. I have some of my own critique of what I think where we're at in terms of what I was hoping the Kerry speech would have added, a little some self-reflection as well. I think you'll hear remarks that are very anti and not very supportive. I'll try to be down the middle as much as I can in trying to explain to this audience what I think is new, why now, and what does it mean? Where was the mistake? What could have been done differently? In terms of what's new, I mean, that has to be prefaced by saying the United States has had three major efforts. Some of you know me, know I'm a big baseball fan, and know that I sometimes use baseball metaphors, so for those who don't like that, I'm sorry. But the U.S. has tried to hit the home run ball on this issue of solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict now three times. Bill Clinton in 2000 with Camp David, and leading to what's known as the Clinton Parameter Speech in December 2000. You'll see why that term is important. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice made an effort in Annapolis, that conference at the end of 2007, continuing on in 2008 between Abbas and Olmert, who were then the leaders at that time. And then the Kerry effort that was a part of 2013-14. Those are the three major efforts to hit the home run ball. I think they were noble efforts. I've already disclosed I was part of the third. But as I will say that I think, the critique is why didn't we try to hit singles when we realized we couldn't hit a home run? So how is this speech different? Manish Tana, what's new here compared to what Clinton, his efforts in December 2000? Basically, he convened a summit in July 2000 at Camp David to try to solve this. And then in December, after the U.S. election, also in the waning days of his presidency, he'd try to put forward his own ideas. The Kerry ideas are not dramatically different, but they have some important differences. There were some partial efforts in the middle of that. I mentioned a broader effort by Condi Rice, but there was a letter by George Bush to Ariel Sharon in May 2004, and the Obama speech speeches. Maybe one of you, some of you, were at the AIPAC speech in May 2011. Those are the basic reference points for how the U.S. sees, how does this end up? What's the end game? Give me the bottom line. And so it would be interesting to say, okay, how is the Kerry thing different from, let's say, Clinton, which was the first, and this is the latest. They were both done at the end of the presidency. Let's say Clinton was the president, Bush was the president, Bush, Obama president, Kerry a secretary of state. I think there are differences in context and substance. Clinton's came 8 years after his direct Israeli Palestinian negotiations. Those who remember the Oslo Accords, the 8 years that ran up, and the final year that was dedicated to the end game and not just getting the thing launched with a handshake on the White House lawn in 1993. But in the last 8 years of Obama, sadly, there has not been hardly any engagement of the leaders themselves because of the acrimony and differences between Netanyahu and Abbas. So the U.S. has done much of the lifting. You could say maybe that's why Kerry is more frustrated. And that was accentuated in 2013-14 when the process failed in April of 2014. Then the Ukraine, people forget that issue popped up. Then ISIS popped up. And basically, you could say, why didn't he give the speech then? We'll get to that in a moment. But basically, he's reflecting on that intense period of 2013-14. Now, what did Kerry say different than Clinton and the others? Look, on the Kerry, I mean, when Clinton was president, the issue about Jewish state was not as pronounced because there was no really Palestinian questioning as much of the Jewish character of Israel. It started with Arafat, but it wasn't as pronounced as it is today. Obama did explicitly call for any deal to include Jewish state as a centerpiece, not just Israel, in his 2011 speech, and it was repeated by Kerry yesterday. On the issue of Jerusalem, it's the first time that an American, and this is probably a headline kind of for American Jewish groups, it's the first time that an American president, American leader, Kerry's own Secretary of State, is called for Jerusalem as, quote, the internationally recognized capital of two states. The United States has not done that. Although in 2001, at a speech at what's called the Israel Policy Forum at the Waldorf a few days before leaving office, Clinton didn't use that term capital. But in the actual parameters where he gets into some details about who's sovereign over what at the Temple Mount, but he didn't get into the term capital, which was then considered very sensitive in the Jewish community and the like. So this is the first time that that has kind of made its way into a policy speech in the same way. Clinton said his ideas were leaving with him, but in fact they have not, and they have been kind of the baseline very much. On the issue of refugees, Kerry was a little more explicit, saying that the refugee issue has to be based on the idea of two states for two peoples. And that is a more restrictive bar for the Palestinians, saying, because they like an unfettered right of return. Israel thinks just saying it can't change the Jewish character of Israel because it has to reflect two states for two people and Israel's Jewish. That's not enough. Israel would like the U.S. to adopt a higher bar, and that bar being just no right of return. So Kerry kind of took a middle position there. But on the issue of borders, they're more similar than different. Clinton's parameters of December 2000 were not based on 100% of the West Bank, but were based on an average of 97%. I could do the calculations with you. I don't know if you want to take up the time for that. But it was based – since then, the idea of 100% has kind of been what was understood, but they were talked about the idea of land swaps. Kerry took it a little bit further yesterday, talked about mutually agreed equivalent land swaps. Palestinians say equal land swaps, which they like to say that deals with the land quality. That means if Israel wants to keep 5% of the land because that's where 80% of the settlers live and 5% of the land inside the security barrier, then Israel gives 5% somewhere else. Palestinians say, okay, we have no problem with land swaps. We'd like them smaller, but we want them equal, and that usually means you get into very technical issues, defining land quality, which is impossible to do often. The Bush letter to Sharon said that there would be major population centers, that was his term for settlement blocks, but he said that would be based on mutually agreed changes that reflect these realities. In other words, the Palestinians would have to agree, and that everyone agrees that, well, if there's a final agreement, there has to be agreement, right? Israel has interpreted the Bush letter to mean that Israel could build in those clusters now. That's not what the letter says, but that's what Israel has interpreted it broadly. The issue of security is also more similar, but Kerry talks about fully ending the occupation, this is a direct quote, that is a fundamental issue for the Palestinians. They need to know the military occupation itself will fully end, end quote. He doesn't say, he basically puts the ball in Israel's court, say, when will Israel pull troops out? Clinton went a little further. Then it was an active process, I was saying, but it was also, you could say, hey, it was before the Second Intifada, although the Second Intifada really just started when Clinton put forward his parameters in December 2000. It started in September of 2000. It was before the Arab Spring, where the Arab, you know, the Middle East has been in meltdown mode. It's been a cauldron. So Kerry doesn't really focus, dwell on international troops and doesn't have a timetable when Israeli troops leave, while Clinton did. Kerry says that a Palestinian state would be non-militarized. That's kind of a consensus view. And the consensus of the sides, even Abbas said that this has to totally end the conflict and all outstanding claims. That's in the Abbas speech also at the UN General Assembly of 2013. So in many ways, on the core issues, Jerusalem, refugees, borders, security, end of conflict, Jewish state, there's more comparisons and contrast between what Kerry is saying. He's added, like I said, some key differences that no doubt. Why now? Why does he put this forward now? People say, oh, it's a parting shot. He wants to take revenge on Bibi because he's mad at Bibi. A more conspiratorial kind of assessment is, look, there's a meeting in Paris on January 15th. Of all these foreign ministers that the French are bringing together, Israel says it will boycott, sees it, worries that there'll be kind of a precedent for an imposed solution. But people are saying, hey, is the European conference in Paris going to cut and paste what Kerry says and then pass it as their view and then take it to the Security Council like hours before Donald Trump is inaugurated president on January 20th? There's these 4 days in the middle. So there's a lot of drama here, and I think the press will soak the drama, and the U.S. position might seem a little coy given what happened on the Security Council vote, where the U.S. says we don't necessarily, that we don't support further U.N. Security Council resolutions, but what we've learned is you could abstain, let something else through, you didn't technically support it, but if you didn't veto it, you've supported it because it couldn't happen without you. So I think that's where the media, I know in the Jewish world or in Israel and elsewhere, we'll be focusing on, is there a coda here, the last two steps. We don't know. And, I'm just being straightforward. I don't know. Why didn't they do it in 2014 when the peace process failed? I think you could say, look, the administration got quickly enmeshed in other hotspots. Like I said, Ukraine was popping up. Then ISIS popped up. And then, a different interpretation would say, look, American domestic policy would have meant that to do this kind of speech would have been a political liability for any Democratic candidate running for president. So we don't know. And I always say when we don't know, I do have some thoughts on this, but I can't really share some of that because some of it is why I went in government. So I'm just putting out there, different interpretations. I do think, to be fair to Kerry, I did have witnessed him up close. I do think that he cares deeply about this. He thinks he's saving Israel from itself, and that if it wants to be a Jewish state and democratic, he's got to pass on the lessons. He's not just going to kind of quietly walk off the stage that way. So I personally believe it is genuine with him. Does it have a knock-on effect in Paris and in the Security Council in these final days, adding to drama? I leave that I just don't know now that I'm on the outside. The last point I want to make before opening up is, you say, well, what's your critique of these guys? My critique is, like I said, I think it was a noble effort to try. to hit the home run ball the third time, 2013-14, that was effort I was a part of. But I think, you know, and I think, you know, we couldn't do the front door. We tried the side door, the back door, the window, the basement, the chimney. No, we didn't want any dissertation written, you know, 30 years from now, the Americans, you know, weren't creative enough in trying to solve this conflict. And clearly, you know, Kerry has, you know, you could say he's made it clear it wasn't just Israel here, but there was the issue of what about the incitement? What about terrorism? What about stopping, you know, money to martyrs foundations that were funding suicide bombers? I mean, there's the onus shouldn't be seen as on Israel. He did mention yesterday Hamas rejectionism and Palestinian incitement, but he certainly was more passionate and frustrated by the settlements. My critique is simply, you know, having tried what we tried in 2013-14, why didn't we try a single in 2014 through 16? Why didn't, once it failed, say, okay, these guys can't do it. The Venn diagram does not overlap on these core issues that we've just gone through. And I think that's a question that's still very much open. I mean, if you're trying to stop the slide to the one-state solution, isn't the single here very clear? Palestinians take steps on, like I said, the martyrs foundations and the incitement, trying to promote grassroots activity, not, you know, ban normalization of Palestinian grassroots groups with Israel, come out against it. And Israel says, okay, you know what? We're not going to do a full freeze, but we're not going to settle outside the fence, outside the barrier. 92% of the West Bank is outside the barrier. Almost all the Palestinians live outside the barrier. 80% of the settlers live inside the barrier. 80% maybe closer to 75%. We can get into technical things. I'm not including East Jerusalem, and that if you include that, the number is more like 90%. But Israel doesn't consider East Jerusalem settlement. So the question is why not the single? Why not say here, let's maintain the viability of a two-state outcome, even though we can't implement a two-state approach. That would have been the single. And then it would have been a payoff for Israel, a little more flexibility in select settlements inside the fence in return for not doing it outside the fence and putting something on the Palestinians on the incitement issues. I think that would have been the single. And, you know, the president's speech in May 2011, what I said was, you know, it was going to be based on this idea of swaps, so land exchanges. That means there will be settlements that will be part of Israel. But somehow the president's speech of May 2011 did not really reflect itself in the day-to-day policy of the administration. Now, to be fair to the administration, it's not just the administration. It was also Israel, and this government is also built outside the barrier as well. Each side has had an undifferentiated view of settlements, while each side needed a more differentiated view. Now, the question is why? Why on the American side? Is there the issue of ideology? The administration didn't believe there's good settlements and bad settlements, even though Abbas said, you know, some percentage of this is going to be Israel anyway. The administration came in saying we don't accept the legitimacy of any further settlement activity. But I think it wasn't just ideology. To be fair, I think there was also that the poor relationship between Obama and Netanyahu meant they couldn't believe it would be actually enforced. Even if they cut a kind of an inside the barrier, outside the barrier deal with Israel. And that's where the poor relationship, and that was based on the loopholes that were built into the 2009-2010 settlements freeze issue that existed back then. So there was bad blood. I think you put the suspicions aside. If the stakes are as high as you say, which is they're sliding to a one state, you know, try for the single if you can't hit the home run. And that's the disconnect in all this, that whenever it's all or nothing in the Mideast, it tends to be nothing. I want to be clear. I don't want to just blame the United States, and I don't think it's fair to blame Kerry. I think the White House makes the final call in our American presidential system, as you know. I think Israel, too, needs an internal introspection on why they didn't go differentiated, why they didn't put forward the singles approach. And I think that needs to be discussed. So what does it all matter? People say it doesn't matter. Trump's coming in. It doesn't matter. You know, it's good for think tanks and that. But what we saw with Clinton was that ideas that he put forward in 2000 were really the baseline for this speech yesterday, even though there are some, like I said, important differences. And whether there's a Security Council put forward by the Europeans or not, and the U.S. abstains or not, and then I think we'll see a real explosion coming out of Israel. I don't know if it'll be along the lines of the Iranian nuclear deal, but but this is, you know, so it could be that this, the drama plays out in these final days, or it could be that this is shelved, but the issue comes back in a different way, and maybe Trump's policies might change, maybe Israel's policies might change. So I don't think it's fair to say it's all irrelevant. I do think the speech could have been more balanced. It could have been more even-handed about where the Palestinians have gone wrong, although it does have that, and it's wrong to say it was only focused on Israel. There was considerable talk about Palestinian, where they have gone wrong on the incitement issue, although they don't explain that. Why didn't Abbas accept the Olmert offer in 2008, and why didn't Arafat accept, you know, the Barak offer in 2000? That looks like that there wasn't some problems on the Palestinian side. There's a lot of blame to go around. So in summary, you know, that's what I try to address in these remarks. You know, what's the context? What's different? Who were they? How many times did the U.S. try to hit that home run ball? How does this one look different than the others? And where is the critique in terms of the road not taken? If you couldn't hit the home run ball, why didn't you go for singles? Like I said, I don't think I would put all the blame on the White House. I think Israel also needs to have some introspection, but I think it's fair to ask the administration some of these questions as well. So why don't I stop here, and I want to try to keep to enable time for questions, and I'll go as long as you need. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, David. Christy, our operator, remind everybody how to ask a question again.
Sure. To ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star 1.
Okay, and while we are queuing up the questions, let me ask the first question, David. Am I being unfair then, based on the last thing you said? You know, if I say that I was very concerned both by the action at the Security Council and by the speech yesterday for what it didn't discuss, because there was sort of this, I don't want to call it a moral equivalency, but sort of an equivalency of what each side has not done and should have done, where, as you just pointed out, in 2000, Barak made an offer that covered many of these parameters. Omer, I think, even went further in 2007. Neither right. one of those things were mentioned in his speech yesterday. Right. Israel yeah. does have a democratically elected government, so the people have decided who they want their leaders to be. There seemed to be very little respect given for that, and an equivalency of way the Palestinian government operates, when we all know Abbas is now in the 11th year of his 4-year term. So am I overreacting when I basically say, hey, it looks to me like the world is speeding up on Israel, and with all the good that this administration has done in the relationship with security of Israel, it's sort of going out on a very negative tone.
Look, you raised some important points. Like I said, those past things were not acknowledged. And, you know, it's Israeli leaders have, you know, publicly said, you know, in March 17th, 2014, the U.S. put forward ideas to Abbas, and we never got an answer. I think there was a shading here, not kind of fully reckoning about what was, the shortcomings on the Palestinian side as well. That was evident, and I don't want to suggest, though, that the leaders were on the brink in March of 2015. I think we had, March 2014, I think we had 2 of the 5 big issues. I think Netanyahu went much further than people realize on the land. And I think Abbas gave some indications on the refugees. And I can't get into any details because of my position at the time. But, you know, the other 3 issues, the security arrangements, East Jerusalem, Jewish state, we weren't close. But, you know, I do think we needed an answer from Abbas, and we didn't get it. So I think that could have added some context. The Security Council issue, I was worried it would take me too long on that. I'll just say the 3 implications there that I'm concerned about in terms of a U.S.-Israel relationship is, yes, it's true. The term no legal validity on settlements is not new. It was used in March of 1980. There were other Security Council resolutions that referred to it, but it's coming at a time the International Criminal Court is weighing whether to open a full-fledged investigation on Israel. And that's a big deal. That has not happened. That would kind of criminalize Israeli behavior in a way that has never happened in the past. The U.S. has come out against an ICC move, but now that the Security Council has approved it, isn't that a huge boost for the prosecutor who's weighing whether to open a full-fledged investigation on Israel? Point one. Point two, this is much more explicit than before in a Security Council resolution. Yes, even the Bush statement says, any changes to the armistice line of 49 or what we call the pre-67 lines are almost identical. Needs mutual agreement, of course. An agreement needs an agreement. But to put in a Security Council resolution about, you can't move from the 67 borders unless agreed, I think makes it a little bit harder. And I think it, especially if I expect Netanyahu to go to Trump and basically, what's the bottom line here? He'll say, hey, remember that Bush letter to Sharon in April of 2004? Why not reaffirm that about blocks? Again, the letter was not about building the settlement blocks today, but rather as a vision that it will be ultimately part of Israel. But isn't that harder for Trump to do that if there's a Security Council resolution? Now, maybe not. He'll tweet it out that he doesn't care. But I expect Netanyahu to ask Trump to reaffirm that Bush letter, which wasn't reaffirmed by Obama when he came into office in 2009. The final implication, I think, is that it takes the European Union standard on differentiating between Israel and the West Bank. I mean, starting now labeling of shirts and things like that, and Europe delineating to, and Israel agreeing because it wants this European R&D aid and technology, and saying don't spend money, anything over the green line, over that 67 line. And now that looks like it could be a globalized standard that until now had just been an EU standard. So I think those are three things that weren't in the Security Council thing before. So when you add it all together, I think I can understand why people are going to be concerned about the way this is ending. And especially because, abstaining on that Security Council resolution gave the United States enormous leverage. Because without the U.S. abstention, this thing could not pass, even if the U.S. didn't vote for it. So, just in terms of negotiating leverage on any of these points I mentioned, couldn't you say, hey, you want the 67 line? Well, we want the words Jewish state in the Security Council resolution because you don't have a resolution without us. And that could be true not just on that. It could be true on refugees or other issues. So I think there was if you were going to go down this road, you could have gotten much more for it. I think that is a valid critique. What you're seeing now with Netanyahu and Obama is basically all the gloves are off. The bridges are burned. It's coming more from the Israel side. There's more anger. Neither side is talking about the diplomatic, the legal implications of this Security Council thing, because I think for the U.S. it's rubbing more salt in the wound. There's an American Jewish domestic angle to this. And Israel doesn't want to, encourage its detractors by saying, oh, this is good for the people of the ICC who want to investigate us. So, any way you look at it, neither side is talking about these implications, but I think they're there. And so I think Netanyahu, who's waiting for Trump, is furious with the Security Council thing. The speech they really expected more. And the truth is, even the Security Council resolution was something that the PA announced in October they were going to do. So it's been in the press that this thing was coming. The question is, Netanyahu is accusing the administration of orchestrating it by abstaining and driving the whole process and using some very strong words that would not be used if they still had a working relationship. So I think for Netanyahu, the bridges are burned. He feels, of course, the U.S. move precipitated this. It's gotten very personal, using very charged language, and he's waiting for Trump. And maybe he feels by using charged words, he deters these final days moves in the Paris conference and another Security Council vote. Cut and pasting these Kerry ideas. So it's gotten highly personal, and there's no pretenses left. And Netanyahu is waiting for a new administration.
Makes sense. Thank you. Okay, operator, please open it up to the questions.
Your first question comes from Fred Baumgarten of New York City.
Good morning. Thank you very much. One of Kerry's early points dealt with the word contiguous in describing the Palestinian state. Is he referring to North and Southwest Bank, or is he also, by implication, including Gaza?
That's a good question, and I'll try to be much briefer now in my remarks because I just wanted to address the Security Council piece. The contiguity issue is usually within the West Bank. The land is classified, A, areas which are Palestinian urban areas, B, areas which are the environs outside of the cities. The Palestinian cities are 18% of the West Bank. The B areas that are largely contiguous to A areas, another, 20%. So that's 38%. The remainder is what we call C areas. That's 60% of the West Bank. I should say one is 18, the other is 22. I'm sorry. So it's 40, the remainder is 60. That's what he's referring to. No one believes that there should be, the sovereign area of between Gaza and Israel is should be yielded to the Palestinians. You know, the people are talking about should there be a highway, should there be a tunnel. But it's the land is Israeli, and even that Israel will, I'm sure, insist that it has security authority over that area. So I think the contiguity is referred to as within the West Bank, and a concern about fragmentation of A and B areas and how it links up to C ultimately. The administration clearly would like to see more access to C areas. So that's their contiguity critique.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Steve Selbian, Philadelphia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. I'm concerned that there were so many lies in Secretary Curry's remarks yesterday, and they need to be debunked. And I'm wondering if any of the agencies that have put together this call are going to publicly debunk them, publicly condemn some of the things he said. And the other question I have is I'm wondering why Secretary Curry kept referring to Israel when it really was Jewish holy places that he is condemning to put in the hands of the Palestinian Arabs.
Look, on the first question, you have to speak to JCPA and JFNA. I don't speak for them. I'm sure you'll have an opportunity to contact them directly. On the issue of the holy sites, he doesn't really get into that. He talks about maintaining the status quo of religious access. Where that would fit in sovereignty, he doesn't really address that directly the way the Clinton does, but this doesn't, Kerry does not, about the sovereignty dimension.
Thank you. Your next question is from Stuart Schlossman of New Jersey.
Yes, hello, and thank you very much for this phone call. So I want to ask a question the other way. I was in Israel during the election, and Bibi, the Prime Minister, made it very clear that not on his watch was there going to be a solution for peace with two states. The right-wing coalitions, which give him his power, have said the same thing. So if you don't look at what he says now, but look at his actions, it's clear Israel is not going to accept a two-state solution, but yet he's in favor of peace. How would a one-state solution in terms of making peace work?
It's a very good question. I mean, look, I think when I referred to singles, by the way, I referred to the idea that Israel would maintain full security operations as they do today. The Israeli critique is that the Middle East is a cauldron. And, if you withdraw, you're more vulnerable, not more secure. I just don't think that we're on the cusp of a grand deal anytime soon. So I think singles, which says here, at least I could see where this Palestinian state's going to be. But in the meantime, Israel is going to have to maintain security. I think that's really the best you can hope for at this time. But I think that your implied question, is really correct, which is if you don't have an approach, how do you avoid Israel becoming a binational state? You know, its founders wanted to be Jewish. And if, you know, maybe it won't be exactly 50-50, maybe it's 53-47 or 52-48 or whatever, but it's going to be a very difficult situation if Israel has to give, you know, citizenship to all the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. So I think that's the question. You know, its founders saw Israel as an airship that had two wings to the aircraft, both Jewish and democratic, of course, with equal rights for all citizens, whether Jewish or Arab. But if it doesn't make these hard choices, there's a problem there. But I just don't think it's realistic to believe that the security piece can be achieved now. And because I just think Israel, you know, because of the Middle East is really had a real, you know, it's been volcanic in the last few years. But can you work towards it? Can you make steps? I just feel that the Arab critique of the 90s was that the U.S. is too incremental. But no one writes the opposite, that the last three times we really internalized in the United States the Arab critique, which was to say, we're tired of the salami, we want the grand deal, and yet it couldn't be done. So therefore, I come on the side of trying to hit the single when after we've tried to hit the home run ball three times. But I agree with you that if we don't see the parties at least making progress, I think this question of Israel as binational has an impact on Israel's Jewish character. That's my personal view. I do think Kerry is motivated by that. In part, I can't read the guy's mind on everything, but I do think there's an element of sincerity here that he really is concerned. Whether he should be able to do that, against the will of the democratically elected government of Israel, I leave this for you to point out. I've said my critique, but I do think he raises some important points. And unlike the Security Council resolution that doesn't bring the Israeli narrative at all into this or the Jewish narrative onto it, he at least tried to address some of those issues, even if you could argue, as has been argued by many, that he gave it somewhat short shrift and didn't get into some of the history of this about why the last efforts really did fail.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Ken Stein, Atlanta, Georgia.
Hello, David.
Hello, Ken.
You and I spend a lot of time with context and perspective, and oftentimes you've given talks when you've said, put your tray tables up, put your seat upright, fasten your seat belts. There's a landing coming ahead. It could be a hard landing. I'd like to ask you about the hard landing 6 months from now. What does the events of the last month or coming up in January, where does that fit if we look back in it in June or July of 2017?
Yeah. It's an excellent question because for those of you who weren't at breakfast with Ken and me in Jerusalem last week, June is the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. Inside the Jewish community, it will be seen in Israel as the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. But once you leave the American Jewish community and go to college campuses and other parts, you know, it'll be seen as 50 years of occupation. It's a big moment. And what exacerbates it is that little-known fact is that, the U.S. law calling for moving the embassy to Jerusalem is there has to be a presidential waiver according to the law. If you don't want to do it, and the president says it's against the national security interests of the United States, doesn't get into details, you know, does it put American diplomats at risk at different embassies and the like, the president signs a waiver every 6 months. Well, he just signed one, President Obama, on December 1st, of 2016. That means on June 1st, 2017, does President Trump sign the next waiver? Now, that date is kind of a big moment because it's 5 days before the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, where Israel, won, in unified Jerusalem. Israel says that the Arabs wouldn't have done what it did. It wouldn't have had the war. We can get into the history. But the point is the way I read Ken's question is, is it a good idea to move the embassy and use that 50th anniversary? And the why, assuming that's the timing they're going to use, who knows? I mean, Trump could come on a visit here and decide it at an earlier point. But we hear that he's serious about it. And there's going to be two sides of looking at that issue. One is there's a historical injustice that the U.S. government does business with you know, the prime minister's office, the foreign ministry, every government ministry, which is in Jerusalem. It goes to the Knesset to meet with parliamentarians and the like. And even if the Palestinians get 100% of what they want, why shouldn't there be a U.S. embassy in West Jerusalem? That's one way of looking at it, and I think there's some validity to looking at it. You have to look at both sides of the ledger, though, and saying, okay, what's the downside? The downside is the Middle East is always not focused on rationality. It's Jerusalem is a very emotive issue. Are you going to be able to lay the groundwork in the Arab world and the like to say there should be, this is about West Jerusalem, we are not prejudging East Jerusalem by doing this? Or does that nuance get lost? I remember when, you could say, people say that this is caving in to Arafat's terms. He said Israel's building a tunnel in the old city of Jerusalem. He said it went under Al-Aqsa, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It did not. But people didn't expect that by doing something about a tunnel that rationally should not have had any impact, 17 Israeli soldiers were killed, 70 Palestinians were killed. You know, things don't always unfold according to a rational plan. And you say, well, now the U.S. could go on Al Jazeera, could go on Al Arabiya, can go to the Arab Sunni states. They now have a relationship with Israel and tell them, don't make a fuss out of this. You've got other problems. You're working with the Israelis. It's almost an under-the-table Sunni-Israeli alliance because of common shared threats from Iran, ISIS, Hamas, etc. Will they go along, or will they say, look, in theory you're right, but we're not going to go public with our people? Maybe the best you could say, we'll condemn it, but we won't, you know, do it in an inflammatory way. Who knows? But will that make a difference? This is a big decision Trump is going to have to make. Do you move this embassy or not? And I just, you know, I deliberately, I'm not trying to give my own view. I'm trying to give both sides of the ledger. And I don't know what this is going to mean for American Jewish organizations that have to make a decision on, you know, where their stance is. I think there's no doubt there's a historical injustice. The question is, can it be done in a way that can minimize the prospect of violence, or does it put American diplomatic and, you know, personnel at risk, you know, in different parts of the Middle East? And maybe it doesn't. Maybe things are very different. You could say the 1996, the Arab world was totally focused elsewhere. But maybe for a few people it isn't. I don't know. That's a decision that that Trump is going to have to make, and it could be turbulent in the next 6 months. This is an issue that you should definitely focus on.
And your next question is from Felicia Anker, Nashville.
Thank you for taking my call. You had mentioned the word rational, and I've been reading lately that the basic premise of all of this dispute concerning international law and the very, very beginning of the determination of the land and how it was going to be distributed is still written in the charter and in the basic premise of the United Nations. I don't really hear that spoken about generally. And if those parameters are still in place, I'm just wondering why that hasn't been an argument that's brought up as part of the conversation.
Look, I do believe Kerry mentioned last night that the UN partition of 1947 was about creating two states, one Jewish and one Arab, and they didn't call it Palestinian. Israel accepted it, and the Arabs rejected it. He did mention that in passing. So Israel feels that it, you know, accepted the idea in 1947, the two states. It accepted it in 2000, accepted it in 2007 and 2008. And to Mr. Sandler's point, but it was not accepted on the other side, and that should have been emphasized more. But it was said in passing by Kerry in his remarks. But you're right that a lot of the talk of Arab rejection of these ideas in the past is not always highlighted. Including the, you know, U.S. past efforts as well.
Thank you. Your next question is from Robert Weiner, Greater Metro West.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering, fast forward to the Trump administration, the probable appointment of David Friedman as the ambassador to Israel, and his clear view of the settlement expansion should be encouraged, and the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, what that will mean in the future for Israel and for the Middle East, and and the United States indirectly? Is it going to start more trouble than is currently happening?
All right. Well, look, I hope Mr. Friedman will use the confirmation hearings. This is my personal view, to retract some of the statements he's made, comparing people who have policy differences with people worse than capos in the Nazi period. I hope we can keep focused on the substance and not get into invective and some other statements he's made in this regard. Usually presidents have a right to pick their ambassadors. I believe the new deal that was made by Reid and the Republicans basically says that we don't use the filibuster of 60 votes when it comes to normal appointments. So, the Republicans have a majority. Will he pass it? I don't know. I've tried not to address with the president, his own view of his, he usually gets the right. But I will say that he's, the head of American Friends of Beit El. Beit El is on the, is east of the barrier. I was saying that 80% of the settlers are west of the barrier, in that 8% of the area where close to 80% live. And you could say, look, Beit El is only northeast of Ramallah. It's not that far from Jerusalem, but it is east of the barrier, and that's been his main charity. I mean, not his main, one of his charity. I know he's a philanthropic person. So I hope there's going to be some clarification. I will say, if we use the sports metaphors, the ambassador to Israel is not usually the quarterback of the team. I can say that, having been part of the effort in 2013-14. They're crucial people. They're the wide receivers. They're out there in the field. They catch the ball, but the playbook is done in Washington. So I want to be clear about that. Now, people will say, yeah, but if Trump is picking him, that shows where his head is at. And we shall certainly see about that. So I think there's some issues here and that need to be addressed. And I hope by Trump himself, by, his team, and maybe by Mr. Friedman. Like I said, I don't want to take a position here. I've put forward some ideas I hope that he addresses in the confirmation process. But I think it's not just him. It's the administration itself. How do we hit a single here? And again, not just put the onus on the Israelis, also the Palestinians. They have to do things. Like I said, there shouldn't be a martyrs foundation, where, families of suicide bombers get money, maybe not directly from the PA, but through a conduit, the PLO. That has to be addressed. So I think Trump, we're waiting to hear his policies. And I hope we will. I'm sure we'll hear soon enough.
Hey, operator, let's do two more questions. I'd be conscious of Mr. McCoskey's time, and then I'll wrap it up.
Sure. Your next question comes from Tashoff Burton of Denver. Tashoff, your line is open.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for your time and for your insight. However, I think I've got cognitive dissonance. You characterize the speech as a noble effort and an attempt to hit a home run ball. But
No, I did say that, sir. I said that the three major initiatives were noble efforts. I pointed to the shortcomings, I think, of the speech itself and the critique about why I felt that the administration could have handled it differently. And I said that they shouldn't have tried to hit a home run when they need to have hit it singles, if the issues were as stark as they say they are. And I'm not saying that they're not stark, but, whenever it's all or nothing in the Mideast, it's nothing. And here, again, it came across as, here's the way to hit the home run ball. And I think that we need some more practical, pragmatic steps.
There are two things, though, that I think have really galvanized much of the Israel support community, which I didn't hear you address. One is the resolution characterizes the Jewish quarter and the Western Wall as illegal settlements and illegal occupation, which I think is a fundamental thrust at the Jewish character of Israel. And the second is it would appear to me, and maybe I'm missing something, but that the whole focus on settlements in toto misses the experience of the Gaza withdrawal, in which, you know, all the settlers were withdrawn and the response was rocket fire. And the big picture that's hard for me to understand, and I would appreciate your comments on, is number one, the resolutions characterize the core of Jewish Israel as illegal. And secondly, if settlements are the problem, what happened in Gaza? And I think that, those are the things that most of us are struggling with in this resolution, that make it so difficult to understand and so difficult to characterize as simply a continuation, policy different from past approaches.
Right. Look, I think your point about Gaza is an excellent one, and I would have added that to the list of the Palestinian shortcomings of here Israel, you know, 2007-8, the Gaza situation of the pullout of 2005, where Israel did go, you know, did what was asked, and yet, you know, it doesn't get any credit. And, you know, I said this to Abbas personally, not when I was in government, or else I would relay it in front of such an open conference call, but when I was out of government, I said, you know, if you didn't like the book in Gaza, you don't want to see the movie in the Middle East, in the West Bank. So I think that is a very fair point that also did not get the attention it deserved. But it's also made me very skeptical of the grand deal. A, I don't think it's in the offing, and B, with the Middle East in meltdown mode, I don't think, you know, Israel could pull out its soldiers, and I don't think anyone expects it to, and that's why I don't think a home run is possible right now, frankly. So I'm glad you raised the Gaza piece. On the issue of East Jerusalem, you know, I'm not aware anyone said the Western Wall is occupied in the resolution. This is not the UNESCO vote of, you know, the Western Wall is Palestinian or anything like that. You know, but what happens is when East Jerusalem is put together with the West Bank, people say, well, when you mean East Jerusalem, you mean the old city, and you mean this, and you mean that. So people extrapolate from there. And I think the fact that you did not kind of carve it out differently, you know, in my view, also adds to people's anxieties. And so I would agree with you on that, too. So, you know, Kerry tried to address some of it. I wish, you know, they would have addressed it more. But, you know, don't be surprised about people's angry reactions when everything is lumped together. But to be fair, it isn't the first time that the things have been lumped together. You know, and that happened in both administrations, Republican and Democrat, where, you know, East Jerusalem and the West Bank were lumped together. So that in and of itself, like I said, is not new, but the timing is very bad in my view, given this ICC decision and given the fact that the U.S. could have gotten something for its abstention and it didn't exercise any of its leverage. So I really understand, you know, your concern on both points.
David, thank you so much. Let me just ask one quick question. As you just referenced the concerns that so many people on this call have, there are over 1,000 people on this call. I assure you, we covered the entire spectrum of the political views of the Jewish community. What should we be thinking about as we go forward here to be constructive and to try to help in areas that we all care about?
That's a great question. I think this whole idea of focusing on these final days with this Paris conference on January 15th, there's no doubt if there's a second Security Council resolution where the U.S. abstains, that's going to be interpreted by Israel and many in the American Jewish community as an imposed solution on Israel. And that's kind of the nuclear bomb kind of, resolution that would put the Security Council issue almost as child's play. Now, if there was a convergence between the parties and it would lead them to a compromise, would be one thing. I actually think it would create a baseline for defiance, that the Palestinians will say, no, never Jewish state. We cannot accept Jewish state. And the Israelis will say, never a capital in East Jerusalem and the like. So I think it's important that, you know, the nuance of an abstention versus voting for is a little bit a distinction without a difference. And I just don't think that's something people should do when they're walking out the door. I feel it'll just be used as a baseline by both the Israelis and the Palestinians what not to do going forward. There are those who say if the U.S., if the Security Council doesn't do it, you know, it'll get worse. But I just think you try to impose, you know, these parameters on the parties in the Security Council in the hours before a new president is sworn in. I think that would not be wise. I'll put it that way. And then this issue of where the American Jewish community is on the embassy issue, I think, is another big one that Ken Stein alluded to in his question. You know, is it righting a historical injustice, or is this going to lead to violence? Now you could say, well, maybe you can lower that by doing better, groundwork between now and June 1st, or you can make it as part of the singles. You know, give something to the Palestinians too. Say that the U.S. Consul General, who's the primary interlocutor of the Palestinians, should sit in East Jerusalem. You're not recognizing East Jerusalem. You're not recognizing West Jerusalem. But maybe there's a creative compensatory package. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't want to be on record here saying that I favor that. But I just think we need some creative thinking between now and June 1st on how to avoid some of the turbulence that could very much be ahead. These are two very practical issues that could be right staring us in the face in the coming few months. And I would hope that the American Jewish community, in my view, would go, you know, actively support the singles approach. You know, that's my view, obviously, which is I don't think anyone believes there's a grand deal with Abbas and the Netanyahu government. How do we maintain the viability? Israel's got to, you know, keep its security. That's the most important thing as the Middle East faces all this turbulence. But how can you maintain the viability of a two-state approach, but without reducing Israel's security presence? I think that's something the American Jewish community should think about. Those are three very specific points: the last days of Obama, the issue of the embassy, and the issue of the singles versus the home runs. Three points.
Great. Thank you, David. Thank everybody on this call. As we go into the new year, I think that we should do things like we're doing today. Let's learn as much as we can. Let's listen to each other as much as we can, because I think we'll act in a more rational and more productive way the greater our understandings. So I wish everybody, first a Chag Sameach, Happy Hanukkah, a healthy new year to everyone, and I look forward to working with you the next year as we tackle some of these really serious problems that concern all of us. Everybody have a good day, and thank you for joining us. And David, again, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.
Thank you, Christy.
Thank you. Have a good day.